Speaking about the future, we are now going to hear from a man whose job it is to make sense of the past so that he can give us some guidance on what the future looks like. I'm talking about Chief Economist and Head of Research at RMB, Isa Mhlanga. And his topic is South Africa's economic prospects in a changing geopolitical global order. Can the private sector reform the economy? A little bit about Isa. He is responsible for leading the markets research team covering macroeconomics, fixed income, currencies, and credit across South Africa, several African countries, the UK, India, and the US. The team provides strategic economic advice to the bank and investable insights for institutional and corporate clients. Prior to joining RMB, he was the executive chief economist, member of the Investment Committee and Asset Allocation Committee at Alex Forbes for nearly 5 years. He started his career at the International Monetary Fund local office in Pretoria before joining National Treasury's Economic Policy Unit. No wonder you're not afraid to tell government that, hey, if the rand falls, you can't simply say we'll pick it up, right? Outside his core role at RMB, Isa is a columnist for the Business Day and the Sunday Times, where he writes on the impact of markets, macroeconomics, and economic policy on investments and economic development in South Africa. Ladies and gentlemen, the man of the moment, Isa Mhlanga.
Thank you so much. I think I was put later on the day because you are going to be depressed initially. So if you are depressed and you want to leave, you have already gotten the content in the morning. So that's good. I will try to give you a bit of an uplift. The negative news flow on the economy currently clouds the medium-term potential. But in terms of the outline, I will talk through four things. Firstly, just a sketch of the geopolitical environment we find ourselves in. South Africa is trying to find itself in the present, preparing for the future. So it's trying to reposition towards east, at least from what we see, still holding on to the sources of capital flows, which currently comes from the west. Both decisions to remain on the west and still look forward to the east are quite important. But if we just look at some of the data, they do show that people forget very quickly about wars, as long as it's not on our shores. The markets moves on. Life moves on. We saw in 2022 the Ukraine war, food price inflation spiked, and once the world reorganized and found ways to source food, then everybody forgot. It's no longer headline news, as it was. And then the second point, which is about the U.S. recession. It has been moving from soft landing to hard landing and to no recession anymore. But there are signs that says the risks are still quite imminent. We shouldn't be taking too much risk because there are evidence, there are enough data that gives us evidence that we might actually still see a U.S. recession. And that has significant implications as far as capital flows is concerned, particularly for an emerging market such as South Africa. And then the third one, looking at growth prospects locally, it's a stagnant economy, 0%, focus vary from small negative to small positives, but the big point is the economy is stagnant. Infrastructure decay, load shedding, all of those things contribute to the depressing economic mood that we have. But then on the positive side, as of this week, there was a couple of CEOs that met with the president and his team, and eventually about 125 CEOs pledged support to the government. We have heard this before. We have seen this before. What's changed now? That's the narrative. But again, if we take a historical lens and look at when the private sector was invited to participate in what used to be public goods, what was the result? I think the answer is very clear. The private sector can reform the economy. So those are the four points that I'm going to talk through. Just to provide you with some pictures, this is a chart of Google Trends searching geopolitics. Ukraine war, it spikes. People get used to it. It normalizes. They stop just searching. So life goes on. Same with markets. What markets really care about is change, not the presence of something. The war was the first in Europe for a very long time. That represented change. But once markets got used to it, it's now normal. We move on. That's what we have seen historically across the board. So commodity prices have normalized. They've ticked up a bit with the cancellation of the Russia grain deal. But that too will pass because the world is going to normalize. So what this tells us is every time there is change in a shock in markets, it's an opportunity to trade because we will see a normalization. The same in May, we had the U.S. ambassador speak, and the currency sold off to an all-time high of 1992. Again, that was a shock. It normalized. Things always normalize over time. When you see shocks, it's an opportunity to trade. That's the main point. And then if we just look in terms of how China is now the most trading partner of many countries, far higher than the U.S., 124 countries that list China as their largest trading partner. The U.S. has 56. This tells us of a changing world order that is undeniable. That's why you see a lot of countries trying to reorient themselves towards the East because they can see the sources of growth are changing. And in fact, if you just take the BRICS countries alone, they now account for a higher share of global growth than the G7. That's data. It's not just a feeling. So it tells us that the sources of growth are changing. Emerging markets will increasingly become much more important than what we have seen in the past. And it is in that space where South Africa tries to find itself to say, who do it puts close as these geopolitical trends emerge? Now to the recession. In 2022, Powell says the probability of a recession is not particularly elevated. And then in the same year, he says it's not knowable, which means it's quite difficult. And then much more recently, no longer forecasting a recession. This is over a space of 18 months to 2 years. But historically, policymakers never forecast hard times because that means they will lose confidence of society. So we shouldn't take what policymakers say at face value. And in fact, if you look historically, just before the recession or 6 months before the recession, the US Fed has said the recession is not coming. And then it comes. So you should not take what they say at face value and think we are out of the woods. The risks are out. Yes, equity markets have rallied. But if you look at some of the underlying economic data that are leading indicators, they suggest something different, which is quite important to note. So initially, we were expecting a recession. We thought it was coming. We didn't know when and or how deep. We look at leading economic indicators. That is an amalgamation of the U.S. yield curve, which has inverted the most in 40 years. And historically, an inversion in the yield curve has preceded a U.S. recession 8 out of 10. So it has to be a lot of evidence that says this time is different. But this time is not different because indicators are telling us that it's coming. So if we look at the leading economic indicator, which is an amalgamation of all those variables which capture activity in different sectors of the economy, on a month-on-month basis, every time we have seen 6 consecutive month-on-month declines, we've ended up in recession. If you look on a year-on-year basis, every time we've seen a contraction of 7.5% in the leading economic indicator, we've ended up in recession. This is an indicator that amalgamates different sectors of the economy. And yet, we have a divergence between the performance of the S&P 500 and the performance of the U.S. leading economic indicator. What do we see historically? Every time the leading economic indicator is in contraction, there's always a convergence which is made by S&P 500 collapsing. It happened in the early 90s, again, global financial crisis in 2020, and we should expect that to happen too. If history holds, unless if we have enough evidence to say this time is different. But we don't. Obviously, if we look in terms of what drives the S&P 500 earnings, are driving S&P 500, the economy continues to perform well. So people look at economic growth, they look at non-farm payrolls, they look at unemployment rates. All of those are backward-looking indicators. They don't tell us anything about what's to come. So they are a little bit misleading. And in fact, if you look at the unemployment rate, it bottoms 2 quarters after the recession. That's the historical precedent. And then if we look in terms of the S&P 500 and JSE correlation, near perfect almost all the time, except during the mid-2000s because of commodity prices. Otherwise, whatever happens to S&P 500 is translated into the JSE. So the risks that we manifest offshore, they will be reflected in the domestic column. That's why we should care, even though we don't have significant exposure in the U.S. markets. But obviously, for those that are running balanced funds, now you can take 40% offshore, you will have that exposure. And then, so let's look at some of the recent indicators. Surprise indices, they suggest the economy has been doing well, surprising expectations on the upside, which is what people look at. This is GDP, backward-looking economic indicator. And then you look at U.S. growth has been upgraded by the IMF at the recent July forecasts, which again affirms that growth is still doing well. We are not facing a recession. Global growth also slightly adjusted upwards. So it gives people a false sense of normality. And then we look at what actually happens, the components of the U.S. economy a year before a recession. The housing market collapses. So that's housing investment. It collapses a year before a recession. That's the history. What's happening in the housing market? So if you look at the correlation between the change in 30-year mortgage rates and U.S. existing home sales, it's inverted. So the higher it is, the more negative it is. You can see near perfect. So the housing market is already feeling the pain, which is one of the most important leading indicators of pain in the U.S. economy. And then you look at earnings and existing home sales. I just showed existing home sales earlier on, which is in negative territory. It always leads earnings, and earnings drive the S&P 500. And existing home sales is in negative territory. Earnings are following suit. They have just dipped into negative territory. What follows then, if you look at the correlation between your earnings and the S&P 500, is it should follow suit and start to decline. That's the evidence. Correlation of existing home sales and earnings, 45% with a 10-month lead, which means it's quite an important driver of what happens in equity markets. And then we also look in terms of bankruptcy filings. You can see they have shot up. Every time we have the 10-year U.S. yield at about close to 5%, something breaks in markets. We have seen that before. We are very close to that. The U.S. Fed tells us they still have 2 more hikes to go. The market doesn't believe, but because inflation is still quite high, if we pencil in 2 more hikes for the Fed, something is going to break. Fitch downgraded the U.S. yesterday. This is yesterday or the day before. Already concerned about significant piles of debt. Also, the institutional framework that manages as far as lifting the debt ceiling is concerned, that was in question, and hence taking the AAA rating to AA+ rating. So already rating agencies are also responding because they can see cracks in the U.S. economy as far as fiscal policy is concerned. 2 things that could make this time different is, in fact, that have delayed the recession rather than avoided it. First, fiscal policy is super loose. Outside of the pandemic years of 2020 and 2021, we have seen the most loose fiscal policy in the last decade. The forecast up to 2028 is 6.7% of GDP. That's the fiscal deficit. The historical average from 2013 to 2019, when we had tightening monetary policy, was 4.7% of GDP. So it's much, much looser. Historically, you have both fiscal policy and monetary policy tightening at the same time. This time around, only monetary policy is tightening. So fiscal policy is reversing the effects of monetary policy. That's why there's a delayed impact on markets. And then if you look on the right-hand side, that the U.S. Fed balance sheet, essentially stimulus. When the regional banks failed, they reversed some of the tightening which they've been doing and put much more money into the economy, $300 billion in a space of 2 weeks. Now they're coming back to cost, but it's still much higher. And then another indicator, net savings from U.S. households. When the hiking cycle started, household has so much net savings. That's now depleted, which means the impact of higher interest rates is starting to filter through into the U.S. economy. So the calm that is there, that we see, the performance of markets that we see, should not cloud the underlying dynamics as far as the potential for a U.S. recession is concerned. Again, this is from Google Trends. Every time before a major recession, there have been a reversal of expectation about a recession. Before the financial crisis, so there's a shoot up of recession is coming, and then authorities come and say, actually, we don't see a recession. People forget, only for a recession to hit. 2008, and just before the pandemic, is this time different? It's difficult to believe in the absence of strong evidence. If that's the case, what are the implications? So mild recession for the U.S., continued disinflation, a peak in interest rates where we are, and then the U.S. Fed start cutting interest rates first half of next year. U.S. dollar weakens. Ultimately, that should be good for us when the U.S. dollar starts to weaken. But initially, the message of a U.S. falling into recession will lead to capital outflows from us. That's the environment or the backdrop globally that we see. But what it means for equities, if you look at all the past recessions from late 1940s, on average, from top to bottom, equities declined by nearly 30% at the bottom right corner. But if you look from the start of the recession to the end of the recession, equities declined by 22%. So it means 70% of the decline in equity markets happens from the start of the recession to the end of the recession. That's where the big contraction takes place. So the risks are still there. The moment there is a declaration of a recession, equity markets will tank. That's the implication. Bond markets declined by about 150 basis points. How do different asset classes perform? So this data is taken from 6 months before recession to 3 months after the recession. And you can see EM markets, they get a beating, European stocks, US stocks, commodity prices, that CRB indexes, commodity prices, high yield bonds, they get a beating. And then on the extreme right, it's all fixed income securities. They tend to protect. They do relatively well. So if you're thinking about asset allocation in a recessionary environment, this is the historical performance of the different asset classes. Now, coming to SA, it's not much of a positive story over the short term. Growth is stagnant, 0%, 1% next year, 1.6% the year after. But this forecast, which is very close to consensus, does not take into account the economic reforms that are taking place. That says perhaps we are underestimating medium-term economic growth. And we'll talk through them. Inflation coming down is now within the subs target at 5.4%. Potentially average is close to 6% this year, moving closer to 5 thereafter. Big driver has been food. And if you look at food price inflation as a shock to headline, it's quite difficult to forecast. So we tried to look historically. It has driven headline much higher. But when we go in history and look at food price inflation cycles, we get a sense that this cycle is going to be much more mild. So we looked at 7 cycles of food price inflation. And what we see, if we take all those cycles on top of each other, we take a median cycle, an average cycle, we get a picture that looks like this. Cycle lasts 45 months. 24 months, food price inflation rising. And then 21 months moderating. So essentially, you crawl up the stairs, you fall off the cliff. That's in simple terms. If we check the current cycle, this is how it looks like, which means we have already turned. So what you also see on the historical average is food price inflation can go as high as 18%. The peak we saw was just over 14%, and it has now been declining for 2 consecutive months. So food price inflation has peaked, which is what we expect. But what can go wrong? So first, the reasons: fertilizer prices, crude oil prices have been coming down, food prices in dollar terms have been coming down, maize and wheat future prices have also been coming down. So they support the moderating food price inflation. But then we have El Nino, which is a season of below average rainfall. Normally, lasts about 2 to 3 years, which leads to a decline of maize harvest by about 50%. That 2015-2016 season. This time around, it's coming following a season of above average rainfall. So moisture is okay. Our agricultural economists say we shouldn't worry much. But if you have 2 seasons of El Nino, then we have issues with food price inflation. Second, the currency. If you look here, dollar price and rand price of food, the difference has been currency. A weaker currency automatically leads to higher food price inflation. So if we see the currency weakening, it is going to filter through. And then third, load shedding. The sub-estimated load shedding added about 0.5 percentage points to inflation. But if you look as far as energy is concerned, we have seen a significant improvement, as I'm going to show in the next few clicks. Load shedding is becoming less and less impactful for production because companies have responded in a way that is reducing the impact in their operations. So that should lessen the impact on food price inflation. And then to my last point, can the private sector reform the economy? So there, I will first show the history of the private sector in providing what used to be commonly public goods historically. And then I'll also highlight how it has happened in the electricity sector, which have led to fixed investment continuing to rise, even though confidence has been falling. Also increased load shedding, but we are not seeing manufacturing collapsing, which means we are seeing a response of the private sector. That in support of the private sector that will be able to reform the economy in a way that is going to lift potential growth. So let's begin. I'm sure you have used post office at some point in time. Those that like speed, they have received their speed fines at post office and you pick it up. It used to work. It's no longer working. But we now have other institutions that came in and provided what used to be a public good. I'm sure by the beginning of this presentation, had I ordered food on Uber Eats, it will be here by the time I finish the presentation without the post office. So a private company that entered into a space that used to be a public good. If you're like me, you went to a public school, you would understand the picture on the left. But we now have other players that have come into a space where the public sector has failed to provide in an efficient manner. Yes, doesn't cover everybody, but the private sector has come in and is playing a role. Again, if you're like me, you use public hospitals, heading to be operated three times for the same thing because it wasn't done properly. You would understand, but we now have other players that are coming into the healthcare sector, providing what used to be a public good, but doing so profitably. Then I flew in this morning, and I'm going to fly out today, but I'm not using SAA. Right? Other players coming into a space which was dominated by one public entity historically. These are examples of when the government eventually says, we are opening up to the private sector. We can see the private sector coming into the space and actually solve for a lot of these public goods. Now, just to then give you some examples of how it's happening in energy. So here we're showing you total investment and confidence. Confidence dipping, but investment continues to go up. It's an anomaly, if you look. What's going on? So we look at some of the indicators that are correlated with the private sector investments. So installment sales, credit, corporates, mortgages to corporates, and other loans and advances, you can see they have been rising. Even with the doom and gloom that we're talking about, 0% growth, but we are seeing corporate credit extension rising. That's a positive for fixed investment. And then we disaggregate that total investment into machinery and equipment and everything else. The machinery and equipment is 50% of total investment. It has been rising. Everything else is pretty much flat. So the yellow line is talking to the confidence that's low. The machinery and equipment is related to the renewable energy investments. All the solar panels, the batteries that are being imported, that are being invested. This should say to us the investments that is happening in the energy space is quite significant. And ultimately, it will end load shedding. And in support of the private sector reforming the economy, this is the private sector that has stepped into a sector that was dominated by an SOE, solving for what used to be a public good. Again, if we look at the manufacturing sector, you can see the correlation historically with Eskom supply of electricity has been pretty much decent. Much more recent, we see Eskom supply nosediving, but manufacturing performance remaining relatively okay. It is because of the non-Eskom electricity. But let's look underneath. 40% of the manufacturers, in terms of their capacity utilization, they have increased above where they were before COVID. About 25% are close to trend, 35% continue to struggle. But what you also see is the 40% and 25% that is now above or at trend are also the heavy users of electricity. So they should have contracted because of the decline in Eskom supply, but they didn't. There is resilience that is being built by the private sector in response to the load shedding. And then we look in terms of output in volume terms. Sectors that expanded, if you are an equity investor looking at underlying companies, where do you look in the manufacturing sector? Those guys that are on the left-hand side, they expanded even though we had load shedding. The guys on the right-hand side, they contracted. They couldn't deal with much of load shedding. So if we look at the guys that expanded relative to 3 years before 2020, they are at worst on par. So they are doing well, which means it's actual building of resilience. It's not just a blip. If you also look at the guys that contracted relative to 3 years ago, at best, they are on par, but mostly worse, which means these guys are actually struggling to deal with load shedding. So it just gives us a sense of it's not everybody that is doing well. There are some sectors that are struggling, some sectors that are doing okay. And this is the reason. Non-ESCOM supply of electricity has been rising as ESCOM supply of electricity has been moderating. And then if you look at the chart on the right-hand side, this is the energy equivalent of all the registrations of renewable energy projects. 2022 regulation changes, we see a shoot up. This year, National Treasury says they're expecting about 2,500 megawatts of project to be registered in the first 4 months. That forecast is blown out. Only in the first 4 months, the full year forecast have been surpassed. So the private sector is responding positively to the change in regulation. We also hear there is 66 gigawatts of renewable energy development pipeline. And if you take an average of 20 billion that is required for 1 gigawatt, you multiply that, you get 1.3 trillion potential investment to cover that 66 gigawatts, which is what the president has been trying to ask for from his investment conference. Now this coming only into the energy sector. So what we are seeing in the energy sector is massive. It's not something small. And if you take the SAB's estimate that says load shedding subtracted 2 percentage points of GDP, the moment we end it, it means we add back 2 percentage points. So economic growth can easily lift to 2.5%. We haven't spoken about logistics. We haven't spoken about water. This week, the president met with a couple of business leaders. 125 CEOs have signed pledges to support the government in 3 core areas, that is energy, transport and logistics, it's crime and corruption. So here is government saying, we are opening up, the private sector come and help, which is what government did with the energy sector, and we are seeing the response. If you buy that argument, and you also see the history of the private sector's response, why then should we doubt on energy, on rail, and logistics? The evidence is there, and we can see the response of the private sector. And if you buy this argument, then it means our estimates of potential growth in the medium term potentially underestimate the upside. So be on the lookout so that you can catch that upside in your investment decisions. Thank you very much.
One question for Isa. And we will be going to a break just now, so if we can remain seated till then. Go ahead, sir.
Hi, Isaiah Ashley here from Sanlam Corporate Investments. My question is around the slide that you showed in terms of inflation coming down. I'm sure to many of us sitting here, we're asking ourselves, has the SAB peaked? You know, are we going to see the SAB hiking in the next coming MPC meetings or not? Thank you.
We think the SAB has peaked. Yes, they've talked. They're still open to hikes. They said the hiking cycle is not yet done. But we think it's peaked because if you just look in terms of the forecasts, now it's at 5.4%, and we expect it's going to continue to moderate over the next 18 months to 4.8% in 2025. In that environment, why would the SAB hike? But again, if we take our baseline expectations for the U.S. Fed that has peaked because recession fears are coming and potentially cuts in interest rate next year, the SAB doesn't have to do much because the interest rate differentials will take care of themselves. When the Fed cuts, it widens the differentials relative to the SAB. In that environment, without the manifestation of the risks to food price inflation and energy, there is no need for the SAB to hike. So the same at 8.25 for the remainder of the year cuts into next year once the Fed starts cutting.
Thank you very much, Isa. Ladies and gentlemen, I will ask that we take 5 minutes for tea.